Welcome to the Development Policy Center podcast. I'm Macarena Rojas. In this episode, we bring you the second keynote address from the 2014 Pacific Update by Ron Duncan, Emeritus Professor at Crawford School, who shared his reflections on constraints to growth in the Pacific.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back. Welcome back to the resumption of our plenary sessions. I was at the Labour Mobility parallel session this morning, and I thought it was great. I'm sure the other sessions were good as well. But now we're back for another keynote, and it's my great honour and pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague and my boss, Professor Tom Compass, Director of the Crawford School, who will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, everyone. A great pleasure to be here, not only as Director of the Crawford School, but for someone who keeps a close eye on all the things that DPC does. A tremendous week of events, very proud of what they're doing. And today is another great day. And indeed, it's a great day for me personally because I get to introduce an old friend of mine, Ron Duncan, to provide the plenary for today. Before I begin, let me just acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we meet on and pay respects to the elders past and present. Everyone here will know Ron. Everyone here will greatly appreciate the work that he's done over the years. I'll keep my remarks pretty brief. You'll know that he had a major position in the World Bank, professor of economics here at the ANU, former director of this school, the Crawford School, when it was then called the National Center of Development Studies, with affiliated sort of groups, doing substantial, forceful, powerful, profound work in economic policy, particularly in relation to the Pacific, so much so it earned him an Officer of the Order of Australia Award just this last January. Wonderfully well-deserved, and a great testament to all the valuable, truly valuable work that Ron has done for the Pacific, PNG, as well as the Pacific. Personally, it's also a pleasure for me to introduce Ron because, well, Ron's the person who hired me in 2002. Thanks for that, Ron. I really do think it's a life-changing moment for me, so I really do appreciate it. He retired shortly after he hired me. I never took that personally. I retired, actually, I think in 2003, as I recall. But didn't retire in any substantive sense. He's been working tirelessly since 2003 over the last 11 years, and in fact doing just truly wonderful work. It's a good lesson for me. It shows that when you step down as director of Crawford School, you can do a decade of wonderful work, and I'm looking forward to my chance someday as well, trust me. My fondest memory of Ron, and I don't want to embarrass him, but I love this story for me, at least for me personally. I can't remember the year, somewhere in the late 90s, we were up doing some work in Vietnam, and we were in a fish restaurant, seafood restaurant in Hanoi, and there was a piano, and Ron started playing, and I asked him if he could do Gershwin's Someone to Watch Over Me, thinking he could never do it, and he played it beautifully. I'll never forget that moment. It was absolutely sensational. Since then, Ron's been watching over all of us, in a sense, and certainly keeping a careful, watchful eye on the Pacific. So please join me in welcoming Professor Ron Duncan.
Thanks, Tom, for that very kind introduction. I was asked to reflect on my experience in the Pacific for last, I don't know how many years, and so I've done that. It's a fairly short talk, but I hope it will be provocative enough to raise a few questions and we can have a discussion afterwards. And particularly I want to talk about what I see as the major binding constraints to the better performance in the Pacific Island countries, and to raise their living standards for the bulk of the population who've really seen little improvement in their welfare. Now, a major issue for the Melanesian countries and for Kiribati is their rapid population growth and the lack of formal employment opportunities. In Fiji, for example, the annual number of school leavers is around 17,000, while when I was working in Suva, I estimated that the annual number of jobs available was around 2,500, 2,600 a year. So without the outward flow of Indo-Fijians, which in the early days at least numbered 5,000 to 6,000, the underemployment problem would be even worse than it is today. Unlike the Cook Islands, Samoa and Tonga, and the US compact countries, that's FSM, Marshall and Palau, the Melanesian countries and Kiribati do not have easy or reasonably easy access in migration or employment opportunities to the metropolitan countries, which in countries such as Cook Islands, Samoa and Tonga has served to reduce their population growth. Unfortunately, there is little or no prospect of creating the number of formal jobs needed in these countries to relieve the economic and social pressures arising from their rapid population growth. The fertility and population growth rates are falling, and the youth bulge cohorts are declining, but the problem will not disappear. In fact, the earlier cohorts of unskilled, inexperienced youth are now in their late 20s, early 30s, and still without formal work experience and pose significant social problems in these countries. The Pacific Island countries cannot grow their economies in the same way as the countries of East Asia did. East Asian economies attracted investment in standard technology, labour-intensive, low-wage activities such as garments and footwear, IT assembly and toys. And this could provide employment for the large number of farm workers who were released from farming by the increases in agricultural productivity. While these countries, at least initially, did not benefit from the economic rents from such investments, their living standards improved as a result of the agricultural labourers moving from low productivity agriculture into higher productivity manufacturing. Pacific Island countries do not have the large supplies of labour that would allow them to be attractive to similar investments. Hence, I argue that innovation has a much more important role to play in these countries than in others. The land-rich Melanesian countries, as I've argued previously, should and could benefit from improvements in agricultural productivity given the appropriate conditions, such as secure individual tenure to land. This would raise the living standards of the bulk of the population who live in the rural areas, and it would release labour for possible employment in other industries. But neither can the Pacific Island countries be large-scale exporters of unprocessed or lightly processed primary commodities shipped in bulk, given their small size and their geographical isolation. Hence, they have to innovate to add value to their natural resources, whether they're in the form of tourism, in promoting their culture, or in adding value to primary commodities. As we have seen with Fiji's bottled water and cosmetic industries, or Cook Islands and Samoa's high-end fashions. Opening of migration opportunities for at least some of the population-stressed countries would be a safety valve to relieve some of the pressure. But this seems only feasible for the smaller countries. For the larger countries such as Fiji, Solomons and Vanuatu, let alone Papua New Guinea, having migration of a size that would make a decent dent does not seem politically possible. The seasonal worker programs of New Zealand and Australia are a start, but I would like to see a much more integrated approach to this idea of what's now called migration for development. It's reached such a status that it now can go by initials of M4D. So The seasonal worker program caters for unskilled workers, albeit with some limited opportunities for training. But there is no incentive there for families to invest in the education of their children with the aim of diversifying their household labour to higher income jobs in other countries. Moreover, the idea of M4D is not altogether a good news story. Globally, the number of migrants involved and the volume of remittances have increased hugely. However, while the research evidence is that poverty levels are reduced and there is increased household expenditure on schooling, education, health, clothing and shelter, there is little expenditure on business investment, and there appears to be no positive impact on economic growth. This finding of lack of, and there've been a number of studies that have pointed to this, finding of a lack of impact on growth is quite puzzling. Is it due to the researchers not allowing sufficiently for the delayed impacts of increased expenditure on education and health? Or is it because of the lack of remittances going into business investments, perhaps due to the many obstacles to establishing businesses in these countries? Or is it because the more entrepreneurial people in the population are the ones who are migrating? As I said, I believe that innovation is hugely important for these countries. As Professor Deirdre McCloskey recently reminded us here at Crawford, the 100 to 300-fold increase in per capita incomes that we have seen since the Industrial Revolution in what are now the advanced and middle-income countries were due to innovations by the merchant class or the bourgeoisie. These and their incentive to innovate was stimulated by changes in society attitudes towards individuals being free to innovate and trade. Making the same kind of investment with the same technology over and over does increase the capital labour ratio, but it does not lead to increases in capital productivity, and it contributes little improvement to living standards. The early growth stage of the East Asian countries that I referred to earlier did not see them earning the large economic rents from their participation in the production networks established as part of the fragmentation that we've seen for the past several decades. These economic rents in those cases were earned at the financing and the retailing end. It is investment that incorporates innovations, not just investment of the same technology, it's investment with new innovation, new technology that increases, that generates the large increases in economic rents and living standards. If the Pacific Island countries are to innovate and generate the large economic rents and improve living standards, they must do all they can to encourage innovation. This means being open to business, to both domestic and foreign investors, so that new ideas and technology will be invented domestically or introduced from elsewhere. Imagine how much value added has been injected into Fiji spring water by putting it into a square bottle with an illustration of a waterfall on the front. Or how much value added has been given to a few cents worth of coconut oil or coconut butter by innovative branding and advertising. But these kinds of activities and innovations will not take place unless the economy is open to trade and investment, as well as to skilled workers. Recent research by the ADB, published in their annual outlook or key indicators with the special essay there, looked into the factors responsible for the structural transformation of its member countries. Unfortunately, the Pacific Island countries have demonstrated little in the way of structural transformation. They are said to be caught in a low product trap of exporting mostly unprocessed or lightly processed primary commodities. The two factors that the ADB research showed were most important in structural transformation were, surprisingly, the level and quality of primary school, not secondary school as we've long been led to believe, and training to upgrade workers' skills so that they can more quickly become comfortable in working with introduced technology. To me, these findings point to two issues that need attention. First, the poor quality of primary schooling throughout the Pacific, which the education specialists at the World Bank recently attested to here at a meeting at Crawford, and the difficulty of bringing in expatriate workers in many Pacific countries. Resistance to issuing work visas to skilled expatriate workers is justified on the basis that this will take jobs away from domestic labour. But research that I did in Papua New Guinea quite a number of years ago showed that the loss of a skilled expatriate worker led on average to the loss of 11 local workers. 1 to 11 is the complementary ratio. Hence, the Pacific needs to take much more seriously the training of primary school teachers. It also needs to be more open to the entry of skilled workers to help train locals in the skills needed to work with new or introduce technology and new work practices. Of course, I have been discussing these issues from an economist's point of view, with a primary concern for growth in the incomes and living standards, as usually measured in terms of national income per capita. But also, I insist, with an economist's focus on what's best for the consumer. And here I include measures relating to their education, health, and freedom from all forms of discrimination. Some may not agree with this way of looking at a society's performance. There are efforts globally, including here in the Pacific, to look for alternative indicators of well-being, specifically the alternative indicators of well-being for Melanesia project being conducted in Vanuatu under the auspices of the Melanesian Spearhead Group. In their definition, well-being is correlated with access to natural resources, traditional knowledge, and community vitality. Perhaps not surprisingly, Vietnam is measured as one of the happiest places in the world. This work follows from that in Bhutan with its attempts to measure and develop policy with respect to what was called gross national happiness. Now, I might just remember that I supervised the first masters here at NCDS with the Bhutanese working on trying to put into practice the King's recommendation to work on something called gross national happiness. It wasn't something that where we made much progress. However, that project has been abandoned in Bhutan due to the difficulty of implementing practical indicators and the policies that might follow. But I cannot get past the fact that Vanuatu was 124th in the Human Development Index of 2013. Which takes into account the kind of indicators that I see as important. Given its maternal mortality rates and its under five child mortality rates, for example, I cannot see how any community can be comfortable with a well-being measure that it ignores these statistics. In many ways, the culture of the Pacific presents challenges to those attempting to bring about change. Communal and egalitarian values are held very strongly, although to an outsider this sits oddly with the power that the elite hold within communities. The strength of egalitarian values makes it socially difficult for individuals to demonstrate enterprise and accrue wealth. This attitude is an additional obstacle to private sector development on top of the widespread lack of secure individual title to land and the lack of respect for contracts. What I regard as a very important work, recently written by Douglas North, Wallace and Weingarth, compared what they call the traditional societies and modern societies. North, Wallace and Weingarth describe the elite control of an economy, a traditional economy, as what they call a natural state. In such a state, an elite group holds power and tightly restricts the access of most people in society to resources and institutions. This is contrasted to what they define as open access orders, a democratic market-based society in which there is open competition for all resources and institutions. An underlying reason for the difficulty of achieving economic reform in the Pacific has been the lack of motivation to take collective action because of the adherence to cultural obligations fostered by the elite that are given priority over other obligations or considerations. Thus, efforts to improve the efficiency and governance of the public sector are resisted because they would diminish the ability of the elite to control the resources managed by the public sector. In this vein, actions to promote individual enterprise, such as trade liberalisation, providing more secure individual access to land, and privatising state-owned enterprises, are resisted because they would also weaken the power of the elite. Getting back to what I consider my most important point, the need for innovation, I would point out that the elite have not been responsible for the innovations that have led to the exponential growth in incomes and improvements in living standards in so many countries around the world. The aristocracy of England, the Netherlands, Germany, for example, were not responsible for the Industrial Revolution. In fact, they resisted the changes that were needed to promote innovation. As North, Wallace and Weingarth argue, the elite in traditional societies exercise controls so that the conditions needed for innovation do not apply. It is for this reason that I have sympathy for the actions taken by the military through Commander Bainimarama in Fiji. Since independence in 1970, the interface between traditional and modern authority systems has faced considerable challenges in Fiji's democratic evolution. The Fijian cultural ethos of supremacy of what the late Ratu Sukuna described as the three-legged stool upon which Fijian society is based, that is the vanua, that is the land or the chief, or the land is the chief, or the chief is the land, the church, largely the Methodist church, and the native provincial government, maintains a stranglehold over the Fijian psyche. In this worldview, the Fijian is bound to serve his or her chiefs, the church, and the Fijian administrative body that oversees the running of the 14 provinces. In return, the chief, as custodian of all moral authority, wisdom, resources, and prestige, will ensure all aspects of village life function effectively, and the distribution of wealth is according to accepted traditional protocols. This conception of cultural tradition has been sustained through oral tradition, accepted cultural norms and practices, and shared communal values, and is reinforced through the teaching of the Methodist Church. Thus has the status quo been maintained, in which the chiefly elite continue to wield power, enforce traditional provincial loyalties through kinship ties, and perpetuate the people's acceptance of their traditional and thereby divine right to ownership of all land, sea, airspace, resources and people within his or her traditional governing domain or confederacy. It can be argued that many of the actions taken by the military government in Fiji since the December 2006 coup have been designed to break down the traditional institutions that have supported the chiefly elite, such as the Great Council of Chiefs and the Methodist Church. Looked at in this light, these actions may be justified on the grounds of improving the prospects for economic growth and improving income and wealth distribution. However, the important questions are whether these actions will be successful or whether they will ultimately succumb to widespread resistance, or whether there is a better means of achieving these goals. The institutional reforms carried out by the military government have largely been carried out unilaterally, and history has shown that little in the way of changing cultural and social norms and structure can ever be achieved and sustained through force. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Good. Thank you very much, Ron. We've left time for questions. Please identify yourself and try and keep the questions brief so we can fit in as many as possible.
I'm Denise Fisher from the ANU Centre for European Studies. Just a general observation and a question for Ron. In the last couple of days, we've heard a lot about Pacific economic development, including of the American dependencies and Timor-Leste. But we haven't heard too much, anything at all, about the French Pacific. I was just wondering if you, Ron, see a role either as a model or as having expectations, perhaps, of the French government for the French territories in the Pacific in terms of addressing some of these constraints.
Thanks, Steve. I would think that the French territories probably have a lot to learn from what I've said. French aid is just huge. I think per capita incomes in French Polynesia are much the same as per capita incomes in France, or close to it. So, I think they could learn a lot from what some countries in the Pacific have done, and no doubt we could other Pacific countries could learn from their mistakes or some positive efforts that they've made. But I certainly would like to see more discussion about the French Polynesian countries.
He's having a question, so I'll try and put that into a question for him. I wanted to ask you whether you really regard it as plausible to compare the industrial revolutions in Europe with the requirements of Fiji in the 21st century, and whether you don't see some, I'm trying to find questions here, you don't see some differences perhaps between the different trajectories in Europe. After all, France used the guillotine, whereas Britain compromised with the aristocracy in many ways. You ended your speech by saying that, it's sort of implying rather than stating clearly that even if dramatic social change and open access orders can be achieved through force, in order to continue, there needed to be a greater degree of dialogue. But my questions are, I don't quite agree with these analogies, but my questions also are, is this really what's going on? Because after all, Bainimarama, as he announces it, his election campaign is full of announcements of supportive chiefs, and padres from the military have been very involved in the Methodist Church and trying to engineer change. We've heard this a bit before, if you remember. That's what's most likely in future, that there'll be some reconstruction of these institutions. After all, they were changing anyway gradually. The power of the chief was not as immense as you make out. It was much more circumscribed and, and narrow. And I know you don't believe yourself that the best way to secure far-reaching change in Melanesia is by the destruction of traditional orders. You haven't argued that in Solomon's or Vanuatu or Papua New Guinea. Question.
I guess. You know, the comparison I want to make, I don't want to compare the guillotine with what Frank may have done, is the societal attitudes that allow for innovation and what's called respect for the merchant class. As I argue, you know, in Fiji, I don't think anybody can sustain an argument that the chiefs have been responsible for opening up the economy and for fostering innovation. And I think, you know, that's what you have to see. And, you know, in order for Fiji or any other Pacific Island countries, you know, to establish niche markets that's, you know, high-valued, premium-priced markets, you know, overseas, which more than meet their international trade costs, you know, you need innovations. You know, as I pointed out with respect to Cook Islands and Samoan clothing or bottled water or cosmetics. You know, you need those clever ideas. And they, you know, the bottled water and the cosmetics, they came from expatriate people, you know, that's allowing people from outside to come in with ideas. And I think that's, you know, that's what is important. You know, as far as, you know, how quickly you change or, you know, possible to change. I know, and I've written about it, you know, how difficult and slow cultural change is. Although, you know, a lot of what's called custom is manufactured and, you know, to suit political purposes. But sure, you know, those deeply held beliefs are very, very difficult to change. And things like, you know, honouring contracts, you know, this idea that, you don't respect a contract if someone else comes along and offers you more money for what you'd been promised to, you know, for a certain contract for raising chickens or growing orchids or something, just, you know, you sell it to them and then, you know, you leave the person holding the bag that your contract was with. That, you know, to my mind, you know, from work I've done going around Fiji, I mean, that's just deeply ingrained, this lack of respect for contracts. And so, you know, how do you go about changing that? And without a respect for contracts, you really can't have a market economy, because everything we do is a contract. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're buying an ice cream or what it is. They're all contracts, and you know, for an economy to function effectively, you've got to have that. But you know, it just takes a lot to develop that. But if you don't start, you know, you stay where you are. You know, you'll never get there. So. Sure, it's always hard. It's, you know, it's difficult to overcome these problems, but you have to start. And you know, I was having an argument with Paul Holden this morning over, you know, security to land, and because, you know, I believe that mature financial systems are based upon the idea of securitizing land. Well, you know, as I see it, you know, with custom land, you can securitize it through lease for 99 years, just as we have here in Canberra, and that's as good, you know, for the commercial banks as any other piece of collateral. But if you don't have that, you're left with very little that you can collateralise, and you can't develop a mature financial system with all the products that our commercial banks offer us, you know, unless you can collateralised land, and that, you know, that means the banks willing to accept, you know, a tenure to land. And so again, that's, you know, something. It's sure, it's tough. You're going to get resistance, but you know, you just got to keep plugging away.
Thank you. I'm Stephanie from the Department of Foreign Affairs. You mentioned the poor quality of primary schooling, and I'd be interested to hear your views on the use of pidgin languages. And its implication for primary education, but also the ability of those countries to participate in the global economy?
I'm wholly opposed to teaching in the vernacular or teaching something like pidgin. I, It's been an absolute disaster here in Australia in the Aboriginal communities. It was a disaster in Papua New Guinea, and to me it's not the way to go. For better or worse, English is the commercial language of the world, and I think it's best that people learn English. If they want to learn a second language, they can learn it at home. But I think it's not the way to go.
Thanks, Ron. Matt Don from the Development Policy Centre. I wanted to ask you about your comment about migration not leading to economic growth. And I guess my question is it enough to look at growth in an economy? Because obviously if you're considering a country like Niue, where half the population now live, I would have thought it's more appropriate to look at the well-being of Niueans, the majority of them, again, are not actually residing in Niue anymore.
Oh, I'm happy for you to take that perspective. That's fine. But certainly, all the evidence is that remittances are lowering poverty rates. Remittances are leading to more schooling and training and health expenditure on health. It's just a mystery that from all the it seems, some pretty good econometric work's been done by people in the IMF and the World Bank and elsewhere. They just can't show, impacts on growth. And that's just an odd thing that's needing more work. And it's an area where I'm personally, trying to develop some research on that area. It's just a really interesting puzzle.
Ron, this may be an unfair question because you were asked to talk about constraints and you've talked about the need for better primary education, for land reform, for better respect for contracts and so on. But you also said you can't enforce change. It may be an unfair question, but any thoughts as to how one might be able to bring about change?
Right. Yeah, I think that report that I did for you as task leader for the Asian Development Bank on the political economy of economic reform in the Pacific had some really good examples in there about how to go about change. And there were just some really excellent examples of it being done really, really well in the Pacific. And, countries like Australia could certainly learn from it. And just point to a couple of examples in Cook Islands and Samoa had financial crises in the 1990s, and they set about reforms with the aid of the Asian Development Bank and the IMF Fund. It was just really well done. They had political champions in the form of prime ministers or presidents. They assembled a good technical team around them who could give them advice 24/7. They had communication strategies. They had retreats or summits, as they call them. It certainly took a while, and that's something we reformers haven't quite grasped, of how long reform takes. But if you compare that with, say, exercise we had here under the Labor government of plonking in reforms, I think we could learn an awful lot about how to go about it. And the best example in there is the change to customary land tenure legislation in Papua New Guinea, which was led by an ex-PhD student of mine and Satish's. It took them 5 years. He assembled a team of two lawyers and a political scientist. It seemed to be the right set of skills you needed. They had summits all over the country. They allowed everybody to speak, and then they presented contrary evidence on TV, radio, the newspapers, whatever. As I say, it took 5 years, and it went from, years ago, if you remember, there was a couple of attempts to change customary land legislation in PNG, where the first attempt failed, there was riots. The second attempt were more riots, cars burnt, 4 deaths of students. To 2009, where it was unanimously passed by the Papua New Guinea government. So now in Papua New Guinea, a clan can lease land, its clan, designated clan land where all the disputes over boundaries have been settled for 99 years lease. And that can be leased either people within the clan or people from outside. And that, to me, was, you know, just how you have to go about it. You have to realise what it takes, how long it takes, and, you know, development agencies and ourselves, we probably tend to think, you know, it can all be done quicker, but it takes the locals to do it, not people like myself flying in and out and say, do this. It takes people to do it. That puts the emphasis on us to train people to actually go out and do it. From the countries themselves, because I think that's the only way in which it's going to be done.
This is David Ritchie, formerly of DFAT. I have a copy of speech ends up online. I encourage you to do it if you could. A question which is really related to the previous one, and you've started, I think, on the answer. What would be the implications for Australian policy in the Pacific of what you're saying?
Yeah. As I say, there seem to be you know, several now pretty well understood needs to go about reform. And this is, I think, verified by other work around the world. But I think in the Pacific we learned some additional things that need to be done. But first of all, you need this political champion. And the higher up the hierarchy, the better. And for the PNG land reform, we had the Minister for Lands, who then became the Deputy Prime Minister, and he stuck at it for the five years. You need this team of technocrats around them, and able to counter every, you know, query or contrary assertion that comes up in the newspapers or whatever. Someone who can keep providing good advice, good analytical advice, good, you know, empirical evidence about the benefits and costs. So, you know, if it's to do with, say, reforming the mobile phone, you know, what the reduction costs are going to be, what the coverage might be. So, you know, all of those things are subject to analysis. You need these summits and retreats and whatever. So I guess, you know, the important things I say is to understand how long it's going to take, what it needs, you know, from the Australian government, if they're intent on trying to assist in a change, you know, how long they may have to fund it for, you know, how they might be able to help in, you know, identifying a champion or whatever, although I think that's probably best left to the locals. But certainly identifying the technocrats, you know, within the country who are going to be able to carry this out and you know, be prepared to fund all those things. And I think don't take on too many things, you know, at once. I think that's a mistake, you know, we reformers have made in the past of, you know, going back to the structural adjustment programs where we had 145 conditions to, you know, for a loan. I mean, you know, just ridiculous. I mean, prioritise, that's it, and this is where all this work about binding constraints comes on. What's the binding constraint? What's the most important thing to change? What's the next most important thing to change once you solve that? What's the next? So have a list of things, but just work away at the most binding constraint, which is going to give you the biggest bang for your buck. But realise how big that buck, you know, is, how much it's going to cost, but how big it is. Yeah. Good.
Sophie McKinnon from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Ron, you've spoken practically on the need to foster innovation. Over the course of yesterday and today, we've also heard of the importance of increased labour mobility of Pacific Islanders to Australia. I was wondering your views on whether we should also be pursuing labour migration of Australians to the Pacific, and encouraging opening up of labour markets on both sides.
Yeah, sure. I'd wholeheartedly support that. I think, as I said, these countries, in order to foster innovation, you know, they need to be open to new technology, they need to be open to new ideas, and, you know, they need to be open to skilled expatriates who can, you know, help them with that new technology. I thought that was one of the interesting things that came out of that ADB research, you know, how that, in the structural transformation of an economy, which is basically means innovation, you know, how important that that technical help is. And so, you know, being open to those, to visas for workers, I think is very important. So, you know, if we can do things on both sides of, you know, opening up the country's opening up to us and others, you know, is enormously important, I think. You know, and you've got to be open to the foreign investors anyway, I think, but you know, they do need that skilled support, because I know with Pure Fiji, the cosmetics in production in Suva. We rented their house from Gaitin Austin, who's the owner of that, and I'm very familiar with the family, and, you know, the contribution of all the members of her family. I mean, you know, she had trained, skilled people either within a family or, you know, that they're employing in terms of engineers and others, you know, that are behind all of that, what's now a really successful international enterprise.
Since I got the mic, Ron, you know, you worked on microstates as well as the larger countries like Fiji, and you know, didn't hear from you about ideas of shared sovereignty. And if you look at it around the Pacific, the countries that do best are those that have a very close relationship with a large metropolitan power. Mm. And it's not the metropolitan power just in the background, sort of funding reform champions, and the metropolitan, you know, having a very integrated relationship and sometimes actually running the country. So yeah. I just wanted to draw you out on your thoughts around shared sovereignty, especially for the smaller microstates where, you know, whatever innovation they have, they may simply not be viable.
Yeah, certainly, it's these highly aid-dependent countries, you know, it could take a very, very long time for them to be free of aid or to reduce aid. But, yeah, I'm not a pessimist in terms of, you know, them not being able to do better in the long run with innovation. You know, as far as shared sovereignty goes, you know, I'm not a great fan of preferential trade agreements or regional trade agreements. I don't think there's a lot in it for these countries either, within opening up trade between themselves, because, you know, as we heard yesterday, they're too complementary and not complementary in their trade profiles. I think as Satish said yesterday, I'd just much rather see them be unilaterally liberalised and be open to trade and investment. As I don't know what was said at the other meeting today on, you know, where's regional framework going for the Pacific, but I would much rather see a concentration on regionalism other than trade. And so what sort of regional public goods, regional commons they, you know, should get it, could help each other with. As far as sort of relationships with Australia, we can help them with, I think, probably the more difficult things like competition policy, trade practices, which is it's a hugely complex area for economists, and these countries, you know, now that they're opening up, liberalising telecommunications and other things, hopefully, you know, they need that regulatory expertise, but, you know, I think it would be much better to do that on a region-wide basis where they could get sufficient resources to do that, and certainly this is where Australia could help in that respect.
Just a quick question. So you said that land is definitely an issue.
Now, so that means the land reform is needed. Now, historically, we have seen the land, the demand for the land reform is initiated from the roof, because they are the most vulnerable and they are basically poorer. They need land for their own welfare. Now, with the increase bit of freedom that will happen soon after the election, we think there could be a discourse of political process to be seen in Fiji for this kind of land reform movement?
Sure. Yeah, I certainly hope that that's high on the agenda. There's been a hiatus in agriculture in Fiji. The sugar industry's gone backwards because of that aspect. Of course, also because of the loss of preferential access to Europe. Other parts of agriculture haven't been doing very well at all, and a lot of that is due to insecure access to land. I know this quite personally because I spent 6 weeks doing a survey of the agricultural sector in Fiji and talked to everybody who's anybody in agriculture in Fiji and talked to all the producers and people who were leaving the industry and what have you, and the major problems were insecurity to land, people not honouring contracts, as I said, not respecting contracts, and so these are both sort of deeply held values, I suppose, in the sense that preventing people from behaving as would need to behave in a market-based economy, but hopefully there will be more respect for that. And of course, lack of respect for contracts is about law and order. It's a basic law and order issue. So, you need the court, you need the government, you need the courts behind ensuring that contracts are honoured. We talk to the chicken people, over there who give out the chicks and the feed to raise them up and then, kill them when they're fat. And, they were losing chickens because, the cousin wanted to have one for dinner or something. And we said, well, how did you enforce the contract? Well, he said, just basically by breaking their kneecaps if they didn't. So, you've got to have law and order, but, you'd much rather see it done in a proper way.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.